from Park City, Utah.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of When We Cry on Sunday, February 2nd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Siren Theater in Portland. When We Cry takes a look into the pain of a Black woman, seeking to bring awareness to the effects women endure when they remain silent. Again, that's When We Cry on Sunday, February 2nd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Siren Theater, 315 Northwest Davis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we get an update and analysis on the continuing trial in the Senate, impeachment trial of Donald J. Trump. Our guest is Marjorie Cohen, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. For our weekly Earth Watch, we return to covering the vast fires going on in Australia with an update and also part two of our conversation with Cam Walker, the campaign's coordinator for Friends of the Earth in Australia. He's also a volunteer firefighter. And the largest Black film festival in the nation is about to kick off. It begins on February 11th and runs through the 23rd, the 28th annual Pan-African Film and Arts Festival. We speak with its founder and executive director, Ayuko Babu. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to start off today with our weekly Earth Watch. And we are going to continue our discussion on the Australia fires and the global implications. Specifically, we focus on how traditional practices of First Nations people, the Indigenous peoples of Australia, who work with fire and who are deeply connected with the land, have for thousands of years avoided the massive bush fires on the scale that we are seeing now in Australia. We hear part two of a conversation with Cam Walker, the campaign's coordinator for Friends of the Earth in Australia. He is based in Central Australia, where he is also a volunteer firefighter. Meanwhile, the latest news on the fires in Australia, not good. As of Wednesday, January 29th, the fire crisis continues to deepen with an out-of-control fire now within reach of Australia's capital city of Canberra, which has a population of 400,000 people. Officials are predicting extreme heat waves in the area from Thursday to Sunday, but there is a glimmer of hope that a change in weather conditions by the end of this coming weekend, where rain is expected, will lessen the threat. But thus far, the fires in Australia have burned vast swaths of forests, killed 300 people, burned more than 3,000 homes, and destroyed more than a billion species. Estimates of the damage of the fires is around $2 billion, but expected to climb. But of course, those estimates pale in contrast when one hears predictions that it would take at least 100 years for recovery. And the numbers of species either destroyed, many are destroyed, and those left are totally traumatized. The United Nations has already stated that the planet has very little time left to reverse the damage of global warming and other environmental damage. And Al Jazeera is reporting that the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights has warned that climate change will mean 120 million more people will be pushed into poverty by 2030, and that the most impoverished will bear the brunt of climate change, a phenomenon some are calling climate apartheid. In Australia, First Nations Aboriginal lands are being exploited still for coal, uranium, and other extractive industries. Meanwhile, in the United States, Donald Trump has rolled back close to 100 protections for the environment and is now removing environmental protections for half of the nation's streams and wetlands. We want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Watch. If you have missed part one of our conversation with Cam Walker, you can go to the Sojourner Truth website at www.sotrueradio.org, or you can find it on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott on soundcloud.com. Let us go now to the conversation I had with Cam Walker.
By all statistics, Indigenous people or First Nations people are at the bottom of the rung in terms of life expectancy and health and all the rest of it. Now, in recent years, many Indigenous nations have been reasserting their right to control country and manage country, and particularly in the top end, so in the Northern Territory, where you were, many large sections of the country are under cultural burning regimes. So they're managed using fire and other methods, as has happened traditionally. That has pretty much been lost in the east and the southeast, and that was just a fact of colonisation, that the colonisation, as in the United States, started on the east coast initially and hence was kind of deeper, and the dislocation was deeper, and then the communities moved westwards and it impacted on nations to the west later on. The same thing happened in Australia. So colonisation is two centuries old on the east coast and not as old in the inland and the north. So land here is being managed basically in the east and the south without Indigenous input, although that is changing. So, for instance, in the area where I live, the Jajar Warung people or the Jara people are involved in cultural burning practices on public land, and that's been a really important and significant development because cultural burning brings in cultural and social values as well as economic values, as well as increasing biodiversity, as well as reducing fire risk. And I think out of this summer, there's multiple conversations happening in Australia. One is around, is climate change to blame? There's a big, we call it the culture war. There's, you know, the endless conflict between progressive people and the conservatives. And one aspect of the culture war is that it's the environmentalists' fault because we didn't allow enough fuel reduction burning to occur. That's simply not correct. But tucked up in that conversation is the question of how we reintegrate Indigenous burning practices into how we manage land. And then there's a kind of a third narrative, which is this isn't about climate change, this is about arson. And there's some pretty strange conspiracy theories in there that are kind of coming out of the riot around, you know, some people suggesting these fires have been constructed or, you know, have been set for greater political agendas. So, you know, there's those three things. Is it climate? Is it arson? Is it fuel reduction? But in that fuel reduction conversation, there really is some prominent Indigenous people coming to the fore. And particularly in southeast New South Wales, there's a lot of communities with high Indigenous populations, rural communities, and they've been really heavily impacted by these fires.
I'll bet. And what I'd like to do now is to play another clip, actually, about this Indigenous fire practices.
The fear of fire comes from detaching yourself from the landscape. And the fear of fire comes from taking people out of the landscape. You know, I've been to a lot of country that's been like totally incinerated through wildfires and bad fires. And going through Tathra wasn't anything different to many other places I've been to. Not one green leaf left on the trees. No grasses, no sounds of birds. Just a total barren space that once was life. And so going into those places breaks my heart, because we know that that shouldn't be happening, and we know that we can prevent it if we look after the land.
Today we're out here doing a cultural burn at Wallygoot, not far from Tathra, with a cultural burn. It's a lot cooler than a hazard reduction burn. Hazard reduction burn does more damage to the ground and the land than good, really. But with this cool burn, we're going to see some nice regrowth of little herbs and grasses mainly. We want to get them grasses back here. With this soil, we call it sand ridge country. When burnt right, you're going to get a lot of bush tucker and medicine plants come back through this sandy soil. If it's too hot, you're going to bake all the seeds and all the nutrients and that's under there in the dirt. I love land management. I love looking after my land. My land is my mother, our mother, and she looks after us, so that's only right we look after her.
By the time the fire got to here, it would have been extremely hot. And so you get a lot of species that come and back that don't belong to this country. The bracken acts as an invasive native and it starts choking out the area. It's bad enough that our people have lost our own identity through stolen generation, through being dispossessed from our land. But not only that, because of mismanagement of country, even now countries losing its own identity through these invasive natives that are taking over and choking out areas where they're not meant to be. Cultural burning is not just about Aboriginal people dropping matches into country and burning country. There's cultural protocols about burning country. It's about reading country, looking at country, and knowing when to burn. And by burning at the right time, getting back that healthy country will create a safer environment.
The knowledge realm of Indigenous fire management are layers and layers and layers of knowledge, and so many different trees and so many different country types and so many different places and ecosystems that burn all differently in different times of year. And it's very technical and there's a lot of science. Understanding all your trees and knowing all the different animals and all the breeding and knowing all the different bush foods and bush medicines, and like all of that is part of fire management. What Indigenous fire represents is it's thousands of years of getting to know that landscape, and it means connecting to that landscape, it means looking after that landscape and become part of that country again.
As a person of African descent myself, and those of us who have roots of being colonized, and we're often told, well, you're primitive, you don't know anything about science. And it might be that priorities are just
a little bit different in terms of Indigenous people and how they live with the land, as opposed to just thinking the land is there for us to rule over and exploit. And given the deep work that you're doing with the environment, it just seems to me, just even listening to that, that in order to do the more Indigenous fire practices, you really do need to reconnect with the land. You need a deep understanding of what they call the country, we would call land, of the earth and everything that's part of it, the insects, the herbs, the plants, the trees, the frogs, you know, all of the two-legged, those who fly and crawl and swim, as is often said. So I wondered if you could comment on that, because just even having to learn how to do these practices would mean a different kind of relationship with the country, wouldn't it, with the land, Cam?
It would indeed, yes. And I think, as those men said very eloquently, it's around understanding that particular place. And one of the problems we have is that fuel reduction burning is quite it's a blunt tool, you know. It's something that we use at landscape scale and industrial scale, burning large areas of land each year, whereas Indigenous fire practices are based on the local. They're based on what that landscape needs, what species are there, what animals are there, what time of the year are there. So we're actually in a process of a transition from using, you know, an industrial scale tool, which is burning large areas of land and often burning it quite hot, to cooler, more nuanced, more localized, more sophisticated use of fire in the landscape, which is the traditional Indigenous way of operating. And one of the best conservation stories in Australia is a thing called the IPAs, the Indigenous Protected Areas. So these are lands that are recognised as belonging to First Nation people, that are given back into their care for them to manage. In many instances, they're resourced by either state or federal governments to manage that land, to employ Indigenous people to become rangers. And fire is used as a tool amongst many to manage those landscapes. And they're actually, of the millions and millions of hectares of land, I believe that the Indigenous protected areas are actually larger, if you put them all together, than the entire state that I live in the state of Victoria. So huge areas of the Australian landmass are now protected through Indigenous protected areas and managed with cultural fire regimes by Indigenous people, by the traditional owners. And that's absolutely one of the best conservation stories that's coming out of Australia, because built into that is local rights, community rights, recognition, self-determination, the capacity to redetermine localized destinies rather than being just subjected from, you know, the colonizer society. So it's a really great story, but it is around listening to landscape. And frankly, we've not, as non-Indigenous Australians, we've not been very good at doing that the last couple of centuries.
So we all have a lot to learn, really, from what's going on in Australia. I mean, I've heard Indigenous people here in what is now, we all know as the United States, talk about still being owned by the United States government and the papal bulls coming out way before colonization, back in the 1400s, 1500s, are still in the books here in the United States, and that there's actually policy in relating to Indigenous people that are still impacted by this idea of the ownership of Indigenous people, and really limiting in a number of ways and contributing to the genocide that happened then, and perhaps a more subtle genocide that's happening now. So given what you are saying, I think we all can learn, not only in Australia, but here in the United States and in other parts of the world, what is, you know, what Indigenous people there have managed to do and have managed to protect their land. I remember when I was there actually going into some of the Northern Territory, we actually had to apply for a little passport to get into the Indigenous Territory. And that was just, you know, for somebody coming and living in the United States for quite some time, and where you can just go on to a Native American reservation, right? Even the name reservation tells you something in and of itself. And also at the convergence that the Global Justice Ecology Project and Indigenous Environmental Network that they had in Southern Illinois last fall, there was also a speaker who works very closely with people who are living in the forests in Brazil and had a very similar story in terms of how they're able to live with the land and with the forest without destroying it and how much that is under threat. But what a lot of people will know, sorry to have taken a bit more of your time, but is just what is the situation right now? Because we heard that some rains had come and some of the fires were under control. And then we saw that in the state capitol just a couple of days ago, they had to evacuate some people. And then I saw a story of really weird weather, too, of these huge cars getting destroyed by I don't know what. It was frozen rain or whatever, but it just seemed like wild weather going on. But what is the situation right now? Are fires still continuing to burn? Did the rain have an impact in dampening down some of it, Cam?
Yes. So we're only halfway through our fire season, which is really sobering. We've got a long way to go.
When is it supposed to end, the fire season?
Generally December till the end of February, whereas it started early. We had fires starting in the spring, and we had fires in Queensland in winter. So one of the things that climate science says is that fire seasons will get more intense and longer, and that's already happening. The rain has really helped. So the fires that I've been working on in the east of Victoria, I was actually meant to go back to the fire ground tomorrow, and we're having a few days off because the rain has really helped. However, you know, there are still at least 80 fires burning across the country, and very large fires, some of them across the country. There's still many thousands of firefighters out working today. It's not over yet. That hail that happened in Canberra was absolutely phenomenal in terms of the damage that created. Now many areas are getting, the monsoon in the north is just starting, which brings, you know, large volumes of rain that's causing runoff and erosion and flooding and fish kills. So it's, you know, we're such a long way from being out of this. I feel that the conversation will continue to shift, and it will continue to focus around domestic climate change policy. There's a very live argument at present about a very large coal mine in Queensland called the Adani Carmichael Mine, and that's going to increasingly become a focus of the conversation around climate. Long way to go, yes, but yes, the rain has been a real relief. It's just given everyone a chance to, if not get on top of the fires, for the fires to slow down and for us to be able to contain them. This summer, the fires have been so big, many of them you can't actually fight. All you could do is seek to contain them.
Right. And Cam Walker, for people who want to find out more about the work of Friends of the Earth in Australia, what should they do?
A really simple thing to do is to look on our national website. So if you did a web search for Friends of the Earth Australia, you'll see on the front page there's a lot of information around the climate, arson and fuel reduction work, and that conversation, because that really is a live political conversation in Australia. And if you're interested, also Friends of the Earth Melbourne, a search will deliver the website, and you'll see the work we're doing with local grassroots organisations that are doing disaster relief, disaster recovery, First Nation communities that are doing that sort of work, but also wildlife carers. There are hundreds of volunteer wildlife organisations that are actually out in the bush feeding animals at this point. So we've heard more than 1 billion animals were killed, and that's 1 billion mammals, so, you know, large animals. The environmental impacts have been devastating, but the animals that have survived have basically lost their food. So it's actually almost unfathomable to think that we need to feed wild populations of animals in their habitat until there's rain, and hence until there's new food provided. So people are out there doing that work, and you know, the scale that's happening at is unprecedented. But yes, if you look for Friends of the Earth Melbourne, you'll be able to find all that information and links to some of the local wildlife shelters and wildlife care groups that are out there in the field.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I know a lot of our audience get very suspect in terms of, you know, the larger internationally known, disaster relief organizations. We've had experiences in Haiti and in New Orleans and Puerto Rico, where the help and the assistance did not go to where it should. So what we would do, we will post your website information on our social media, and hopefully, you know, we can see what we can do to lend support to your efforts, working with indigenous communities, but also just impacted communities generally. And Cam, I really, we have to lift you all up and think of you and send you all of the best thoughts. It was just heartbreaking to, you know, see the kangaroos gathered on people's front lawns, and they in you know, good numbers when they're usually trying to stay away from people, but they're suffering such trauma that they are now, you know, coming into, you know, increasingly into suburban areas and likely looking for food and looking for help. So we just want to thank you and appreciate you taking the time to share all of this with us, Cam Walker.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you for your time, too.
All righty. And that was part two on our coverage of the vast fires going on in Australia. And again, if you've missed part one, you can go to the Sojourner Truth website at sotruradio.org, or you can go to SoundCloud, look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, and you will be able to hear part one as well. And by the way, the billion, those were 1 billion mammals. That doesn't include all of the other species that have been lost, not to mention the forests with great biodiversity that have been burned. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister of Australia remains a climate denier and a big supporter of the coal industry in particular. What we're going to do now, we're going to take a station break. Coming up, our weekly Earth Minute. And also, Ayuku Babu is waiting to join us to talk about the 28th Annual Pan-African Film and Arts Festival. And Marjorie Cohn will be joining us with her analysis of the latest news on the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
And that song from the First Nations people of Australia, and the song is Wiatol, and the artist is Jeffrey Gurumal Yunupingu. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott, and our handle on Instagram and Twitter at SoTrueRadio. And we're also on SoundCloud. And in our tradition, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners on Indigenous lands across the United States. Indigenous lands across the United States and internationally. Let's give a shout out to our SoundCloud
SoundCloud listeners in Australia as we continue to lift them up. Okay, we are now going to turn our attention to something that is uplifting, better news than the Australia fires, and the 28th annual Pan-African Film and Arts Festival will open. The dates are February 11th through Sunday, February 23rd. And waiting to speak with us is Eyuko Babu, international cultural, political, and legal consultant specializing in African affairs. He's been the executive director of the Pan-African Film and Arts Festival, known as PAF, since 1992. And he currently serves as a permanent member of the jury of the annual Africa Movie Academy Awards, headquartered in Lagos, Nigeria. Maybe one of these days he'll just put me in his suitcase so I can get over to that film festival. And currently he's developing formal ties with the National Film and Video Foundation of South Africa, a government agency whose mission is to develop and promote the South African film industry. Eyuko Babu, welcome back.
Good morning. It's good to be here. Lots of things happening, and we got a lot of things going on with the Pan-African Festival, so it's good to be here.
Right. So tell us, first of all, tell us about the opening and the opening film, but also give us a sense, because it's just incredible, the numbers of films, a record number this year, I understand, Eyuko Babu.
We have over 200 films from all over the world, where there's a black community, black country making films. We have around 100 major painters, artists, clothes designers, and jewelers at the festival. Our festival is located at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza. That's where the art show is, in the Cinemark Rave 15 Theaters. That's at 3650 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, LA 9008. That's 3650 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, LA 9008, on the corner of La Siena, on the corner of La Brea. And on the quarter of King and Crenshaw, and we'll be there for 12 days.
Right, and we know that people do travel from across the United States. This show is being heard in a number of other cities, Eyuko Babu, and Dr. Gerald Horn, among the people that travel each year to this incredible event. Now, this is the largest Black film festival in the United States, likely not the largest in the world, but in the United States. So tell us about some of the films you're going to be highlighting.
Let me say, I was listening to you talk about the devastation of climate change in Australia a minute ago, and I want to say that what we try to do is to bring a up-close, personal, behind-the-headlines that you hear about, the sound bites such as the story you just did on Australia, ranging from climate change to revolutionary films. One of the films we have this year, I want to mention that before I talk about the other films, it's called The Great Green Wall. And this is a film from Chad, Nigeria, and Ethiopia. It's a story of, there's a whole heroic group of people from starting in Senegal in the east and going 8,000 miles, 8,000 kilometers across to Somalia, fighting the Sahara Desert. They are creating what they call the Great Green Wall, which is to plant trees and shrubbery all across to hold and stop and push back the desert. It's 8,000. This film is an incredible journey to see that.
Wow.
They go across, and that's something that's simple, because nobody hears what people are actually doing on the ground, what local people are actually doing on the ground for themselves, by themselves, and it's unbelievable to see this 8,000-mile program of planting trees and shrubbery across 8,000 miles across the Sahara Desert to slow it down and to push it back and stop climate change. So don't miss The Great Green Wall. All of these, by the way, every one of these films will be up on our website, which is paff.org, paff.org. You can go online, look at the descriptions, the times, etc. All of that is on the, as well as some of the trailers on the website. Again, that's paff.org. You can later pick up schedules at the theater, at the Cinemark Ray 15 at King and Crenshaw. on the property, the Baldwin Crenshaw property, and pick up schedules there in about a week or so. But in the meantime, go on our website, and you can see everything. It begins to populate every day. There's new films going up with descriptions and trailers.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, and Ayuko Babu, I mean, the thing that is so unique also about the festival, I mean, there are some films that one, you know, that have a wider release in theaters here in the U.S. For example, The Last Black Man in San Francisco featuring Danny Glover, a film that I've seen, really very well reviewed. But so many of the films and the shorts that you see, once they're, you know, once the festival is over, you really can't find this stuff anywhere. Is that right?
Well, what we do is this. The films, what film festivals do is to show a distributor and show a streaming service that there is an audience for these films.
Yeah.
So that's why everybody needs to come out and support these films, because they all, the distributors and the streamers come there to look and see how many people come out to see these films. And that's one of the most important ways you can influence the getting those films out in a broader level by supporting the festival. I want to talk about one of the films that's our Older Night film called Hero. And again, this will give you insight and a background of the people who laid the foundation for our modern world today.
Mm.
It's inspired by extraordinary revolutionary by the name of Ulrich Krauss. He was a combat veteran. He was he was in the Royal Air Force, like the equivalent to the Tuskegee Airmen, and flew 80 missions over Germany. Then came back and joined with Dr. W. Du Bois, Jomo Kenyatta, Kwame Nkrumah to lay the foundation for the 54 African countries today and the 28 Caribbean nations. And it's a major, major film that gives you an up-close look at how we got to where we are today and the influence of the Black Power movement in the United States, the Civil Rights movement in the United States, the Black consciousness sort of around the world. An unbelievable film, and we want you to come out and see that film. It's a docudrama, so you have actual footage. You actually see Jomo Kenyatta, you actually see George Moore, you actually see Ross McConan, all of these people you've heard about, actually see Dr. W. Du Bois. At the same time, there are great actors from the Caribbean and great actors from, by the way, Trinidad in particular, great actors from Ghana. It's directed by a Caribbean filmmaker from Trinidad and Tobago, Frances Ann Solomon, one of our real major young directors. She will be here to talk about the film and be a part of the film, so don't miss that. It's a fabulous film. It's called Hero.
Yeah, and That's so important. I'm glad you're highlighting that, and glad that you all remain Pan-African, especially at a critical time in the movement right now when people are really grappling as Black people. Are we going to be nationalists in terms of Americans, or are we going to be in the tradition of Pan-Africanism, which I know is your tradition? So the idea of Black people from the Caribbean getting together with people from the continent, getting together with somebody like W.E.B. Du Bois in the United States, so important politically. So I would really hope that there is, in fact, a spectacular turnout on the opening night. Ayuko Babu, we want to thank you. We also want to thank your wife. We know that she does so much work also, and the entire team of the Pan-African Film Festival. So yet again, give us the dates and give us the website and the location before we wrap up.
The 11th through the 23rd, located at the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza property. Mm-hmm. And Cinemark Ray 15. That's all at the corner of King and Crenshaw. The theater, inside the mall itself, you'll have 100 major painters, artists, clothes designers, jewelers from the whole world. And in the theater...
Gotta go.
The theater will be 200 films. Don't miss it. Our website is paff.org. paff.org.
Well, Ayuko Babu, we know you're up to your eyeballs with the festival about to start, so we appreciate you taking time to join us today. Thank you for joining us. All the best. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. What we're going to do now actually is to do our weekly Earth Minute, and then we'll welcome Marjorie Cohn.
The apocalyptic significance of global plastic is detailed in a recent article in Counterpunch. It explains that the boom in fracked gas is leading to a parallel boom in plastics. 300 new plastics facilities are proposed for the Gulf Coast. Their raw material would be natural gas from the fracking fields in the north. So the fight against gas pipelines is also a fight against plastic, 90% of which goes unrecycled. The tiny plastic pellets produced are shipped to Asia, manufactured into throwaway junk, and the packaging it comes in, and returned here to wind up in landfills, oceans, and our bodies. Despite the anti-plastics campaign, by 2030, production is expected to reach 500 million tons. Global plastic is another planetary crisis driven by the United States and our infectious culture of mass consumption and planned obsolescence. Facilitated by capitalism, fossil carbon contaminates the skies and coats the earth in a toxic soup of plastic, both of which will still be here thousands of years from now. If that isn't evidence for system change, I don't know what is. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. I'd like to welcome back to our show Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she taught for 25 years. She has also served as the president of the National Lawyers Guild and a criminal defense attorney. She's a legal scholar, political analyst, writes all the time, books and articles, lectures, does quite a lot of media. So we are happy to be able to have her to fill us in on the latest on the impeachment of Donald J. Trump and her analysis as we're moving forward. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
Okay, so the second week, close to wrapping up. The yesterday and today, senators have been asking questions. And then it was reported that McConnell didn't have enough, because, you know, the whole contentious issue of whether or not to call witnesses. First, we heard it was reported in the press that McConnell didn't have the votes to stop witnesses from being called. And then guess what? By the end of the day yesterday, and they were saying, well, it looks as though he has the votes. I don't know if you have a view on that one way or the other, but your sense of what's happening here.
Well, it's very interesting. The questions are really bringing out the contradictions between the two sides, because the senators are actually participating in the process.
Yeah.
And Trump's defense team keeps harping on the fact that there are no direct eyewitnesses, that Donald Trump conditioned military assistance to Ukraine on announcing the investigation into his political rival, the Bidens. Now, that direct eyewitness testimony would be provided by John Bolton, the former national security advisor who left on less than friendly terms and who is coming out with a book that is so threatening to the administration that the National Security Council and who knows who else is saying, oh, most of it is top classified, top secret, and can't be revealed. And if he does testify, Donald Trump would probably for the first time try to claim executive privilege, but he's really waived the executive privilege by addressing the substance of what Bolton would say. In other words, calling Bolton a liar. Now, Alan Dershowitz, who is a Harvard professor emeritus, a law professor emeritus, his testimony for the first yesterday and the day before is in all likelihood being used as political cover for the Republicans who want to vote against having witnesses.
Yeah.
Because Dershowitz testified against the weight of all constitutional experts. He's testifying that high crimes and misdemeanors means there has to be a statutory crime, never mind that there weren't any federal statutes at the time of the writing of the Constitution. And he said some criminal-type behavior could also be grounds for impeachment, but not abuse of power. And yesterday, he made the outrageous claim that if a president thinks that it's in the best interest of the country to have him be reelected, then he can do whatever he wants, quid pro quo, et cetera, and that's not grounds for impeachment. In other words, if you think you're the best person for the job, you do whatever you need to do. And I'm sure that Hitler made that same argument as well. I'm the best for Germany. You know, it's the best if we wipe out all the Jews and the undesirables. And so that's really a shocking argument. And it flies in the face of all of the experts that testified, including Jonathan Turley, the Trump's own expert, and Alexander Hamilton, who wrote in Federalist 65 that impeachable offenses are political. They proceed from the misconduct of public men, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. They're of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. So Dershowitz's cockamamie theory that doesn't even pass the straight face test, you know, like a dozen GOP senators ran up to him after his testimony 2 days ago and, you know, telling him how wonderful he was. And Dershowitz is really, really off the mark here. He used to be very progressive during the civil rights movement, and he has turned into a real dangerous right winger. And I want to say something else, Margaret, because I haven't heard anybody else mention this. In during his testimony about how abuse of power is not impeachable, he posed what he called a hypothetical to the Senate, and he said this is Dershowitz. He said, assume that a Democratic president, he's probably talking about Bernie Sanders, suppose that a Democratic senator, a Democratic president, told Israel that he would withhold congressionally authorized foreign aid or an Oval Office meeting unless it stopped building settlements. And Dershowitz said that wouldn't be an abuse of power, even though I myself might disapprove of such a quid pro quo demand on policy grounds. Of course, what Dershowitz's hypothetical president should really do is ask Congress to reverse the aid authorization because Israel's settlement building violates the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is part of U.S. law. And the reason that Dershowitz brought that up, and he brought it up twice, yesterday and the day before, is because Netanyahu is in Washington to roll out this so-called peace plan, which basically cements Israel as an apartheid state, completely eliminates the Palestinians from any part in it, and they have denounced it. And he is trying to plant the seed that Bernie Sanders, who has come out against the occupation, Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, he's trying to plant the seed that would be very, very damaging, and that's really Dershowitz's main issue. He's a raving Zionist apologist for everything Israel does illegally and to the detriment of the Palestinians. I thought that was quite interesting that was his one hypothetical that he used in the midst of his cockamamie theory.
Yeah, and even the contrast. I mean, everything you say is absolutely true, and I just saw something this morning that Jared Kushner is now asking the Israelis not to go ahead with the expansion of the settlements until after the Israeli election. Netanyahu's, you know, that contentious election happening. It really is. But even that contrast really doesn't work, because if you hold up aid to say, you know, meet international law and stop expanding the settlements, that's very different from holding up aid to the Ukraine until you can get the president of that country to dish some dirt on your political opponent. You know what I mean? So it's bogus.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. Exactly. A couple of other interesting things I thought. The House managers said that on issues of evidence, in other words, if the Senate were to vote to have witnesses testify, then there would have to be rulings on executive privilege claims, whether evidence could come in, and who is in a better position to do that than the Chief Justice of the United States, who's sitting as the presiding officer. And so the House manager said, we agree to be bound by Chief Justice Roberts' rulings. Will the defense as well? And the defense says, no. no, we won't. And the House manager's Schiff says, well, they're not afraid that Roberts won't be fair. They're afraid that he will be fair. So here we have the president's defense saying, we're not going to trust the Chief Justice to make rulings. And they could overrule those rulings. The 51 senators could overrule them. One other thing that I think is important is on Article 2, obstruction of Congress. And like no other president before him or any judge who's been facing impeachment, Donald Trump refused to cooperate. We've talked about this before, Margaret. Refused to cooperate completely with the House inquiry. Didn't allow any executive branch witnesses to testify. Didn't produce one document. And his lawyer said, well, he's relying on this this theory of absolute immunity. Now, absolute immunity has been rejected by every court that has considered it, including recently, where the judge said that a president is not a king. Absolute immunity means that it's an outlandish theory, but it means that any witness who refuses to testify pursuant to a subpoena has absolute immunity from criminal or civil liability. and so here the defense is saying, well, Trump was just relying on the advice of his Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, which is the only place where this absolute immunity is enshrined. And the interesting thing is that the Obama administration made that same argument prosecuting the Bush officials that were responsible for torture, because Eric Holder, Obama's attorney general, said as long as they were following the Office of Legal Counsel's torture memos, and they were illegal, you know, John Yoo and Jay Bybee and all these torture lawyers, then they're not liable because they were following following the Office of Legal Counsel. And Adam Schiff says, this is exactly the fear that the founders had, the president who identifies the state as being himself. You know, both Nixon and Trump said they're above the law. And Trump said, well, the whistleblower, you know, who is protected under the Whistleblower Protection Act, the whistleblower is a traitor or a spy. And he wants him to come and testify. And Rand Paul, a Republican senator who has moved further and further to the right on a daily basis,
minute by minute,
wanted to ask a question and sent a question up to Roberts to read, and the question included the name of the whistleblower, and Roberts refused to read the question, to his credit.
Yeah. And also this business, I mean, two quick things, the intimidation of the jurors, because it really looked, maybe there was a minute when they could have had the four votes needed to call witnesses. Now that seems to have gone out the window. But Trump's constant attack against anybody who, including Bolton, by the way, Bolton's lawyer says there's nothing classified in that book. So that Trump is yet again lying, right, about that. But, so there seems to be, you know, this tactic of intimidating people. So to warn those senators, if any of you thinks you're going to vote for witnesses, these are going to be the kinds of attacks that you're going to get from me. And then there's the whole business about the trade of a deal. Well, if you're going to have witnesses that, you know, you have John Bolton, then we, you know, the Republicans can have Hunter Biden. And actually, there's an article by Alan Hirsch in Common Dreams that is saying that the Democrats should take that deal. Any quick thoughts on that?
Yes, of course they should. I mean, Roberts would rule that Hunter Biden's he could rule that Hunter Biden's testimony is irrelevant, except that it's not. And there is, you know, there is the appearance of impropriety with Hunter Biden making thousands of dollars. There's no doubt about that. But that has been debunked. So let him testify. And they also want Adam Schiff to testify. You know, Ken Starr, during the author of the Starr Report during the Clinton administration, testified before the Senate. And they also want the whistleblower to testify. And I can't imagine that Roberts would allow that, although, of course, the Senate could overrule him. That would violate the Whistleblower Protection Act to put him in danger.
Absolutely.
More than Trump already has. So, yes, what are they afraid of? what are they afraid of? And they say, oh, it's going to prolong the trial and there's going to be litigation about these witnesses. The three witnesses who testified in the Senate during the Clinton impeachment trial testified in depositions, Monica Lewinsky and others. And that took one day, that testimony. So, the most important takeaway from all of this, I think, Margaret, is that the American people are watching. And that's really the bottom line. We have no doubt that Trump's going to be acquitted. And, he can brag about that in his State of the Union address if McConnell, pushes it through.
Coming up on February 4th, right, the State of the Union. Yeah. So they want to wrap this thing up. Yeah.
The American people are watching, and they're not dumb. And in the polls, the support among the American people for witnesses is over 70%. A majority think that he's guilty. A strong majority think that he should be removed. And so that's happening while people are riveted to this. I'm sure the ratings are off the charts. A lot of it is kind of arcane, but the people really can see the bottom line takeaway, which is that the president is corrupt. He committed an impeachable offense. And his legal team is doing back somersaults to try to cover it up and keep the truth from coming out, more of the truth from coming out.
Right, and Republicans are letting him get away with it. We really are out of time, Marjorie Cohn, but to be continued, we hope that you'll find some time to join us again and we continue this discussion. Meanwhile, Lev Parnas, by the way, went with his lawyer to Washington, D.C. He's Giuliani's fixer, an important role in all of this, Trump's operation there, but he wasn't let in the building. So this is a drama that's going to continue. Thank you so much, Marjorie Cohn.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team. I'd like to thank Kiana Williams, our engineer for today. Romero Funes, our assistant producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:55 a.m. Next up, we have Hard Rock Radio. We hear an encore broadcast from Hard Rock Radio where host Davey D interviews Sophia Chang, a music industry veteran, about her book, The Baddest Bee in the Room. Then at 10 a.m., we have Radio Zine. We hear a special program produced by the Oregon Community Media about weed legalization in Portland. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11, which welcomes Ghanaian hip-hop artist, filmmaker, and visual artist Blitz Bazuwale, a.k.a. Blitz the Ambassador, and Rana Nunchwander, Associate Director of the 30th Cascade Festival of African Films. Then at 11, it's Mr. Jones' Neighborhood host Ken Jones speaks with local writers Margaret Malone, Karen Russell, Kimberly King Parsons, and Lydia Yuknavich. All these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series, featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least six nations. For 6 years, Ryder has been band leader for jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of All Things Must Pass, a 50th anniversary celebration on Saturday, February 1st, from 8 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. All Things Must Pass was a triple album released by George Harrison in 1970, and this tribute event will feature 30-plus musicians from Portland's music scene who will perform the first four sides of the record. Again, that's All Things Must Pass, a 50th anniversary celebration on Saturday, February 1st from 8 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show with a portion of proceeds donated to the Jeremy Wilson Foundation Musicians Emergency Healthcare Fund. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, your parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen, and whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. On the phone line with us this afternoon is somebody who is a quiet but powerful fixture in the world of music and in the world of hip-hop. Her name is Sophia Chang. She just put out a book called The Baddest Bee in the Room. But she's also somebody who we know as a primary figure in the development and the evolution of Wu-Tang, where she managed, you know, RZA, GZA, and ODB. Souls of Mischief have mentioned her in their documentary. She was an A&R, you know, somebody who developed artists for Jive Records. And that's just the beginning. She's done so much. And yet, you know, oftentimes when we talk about powerful people in the industry, you know, her name is just not in the forefront, but it really should be. So she's written a book, and it's one that is being well received. So, first of all, Sophie, welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing great. Thank you for that very kind introduction. You said the baddest bee in the room. Am I to assume that I'm not allowed to curse?
Well, you know, I don't mind, but you know, some of our other folks may be like, "Why is he using the B word?" So we'll keep it
okay.
PC.
Okay.
But let's start off with that. Why did you name the book with such a provocative title? And I'm asking this in this context, that when we hear that word and the baddest in front of it, we often think of the rap artist Trina out of Miami, who, you know, kind of used that as well. Why use that? Is that a word of empowerment? Is that to make a statement? Or is there something else to that?
I think it's both of those things. What I would ask people to look at when they question the title is that